I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As Kansas City struggles to find solutions to fund affordable housing, fight violent crime, and do its part to combat climate change, it's also in the midst of municipal elections. Today we ask candidates for the 4th District at large how they plan to move the city forward and meet the needs of residents in a district that goes from the plaza, north to River Market, and across the Missouri River. Then, the current Poet Laureate of Kansas wasn't born there, but he doesn't let that keep him from calling Topeka home. We'll talk with Waskar Medina about his approach to wordcraft, and he'll share poems from his forthcoming book. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Kansas City's 4th District includes far more than the Country Club Plaza and the Ward Parkway corridor. These days, it reaches into the Northland and covers Kansas City's historic Northeast neighborhoods. Now, as part of our ongoing coverage of the candidates for the City Council, a conversation with the two finalists for the 4th District at-large seat that all city voters will have a chance to weigh in on come June 18th. The two candidates are the incumbent, that's Catherine Shields, who is in her second stint on the City Council, having also served from 1987 to 1994. She's a former Jackson County executive. Councilwoman Shields, welcome back. Nice to have you.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Robert Westfall has spent much of his professional career working in the learning and development field, designing programs to improve the skills and training of workers and job seekers. Robert, nice to have you too.
Thank you, Steve.
Before we get into the issues, tell us about yourself. Robert, I'll begin with you.
Well, I was born and raised here in Kansas City. My family moved here from the East Coast before I was born. My dad used to travel from city to city for his job, but when I was born, my mom convinced him to stop doing that, thankfully. I went to St. Truth Catholic Grade School, went to Park Hill High School, graduated from University of Missouri, where I studied business and public policy. My mom died when I was 8, and my sister basically raised me from then on, and so to this day, I consider her one of the most selfless people I ever met. And when I tell people about my background, I have to talk about the fact that I had a lot of opportunities given to me based on the fact that I grew up in a middle-class home. I was white. I had support in a family network, had education. And then in my late teens and early 20s, I developed a problem with alcohol. And I basically squandered a lot of those opportunities by committing multiple DUIs. So around the age of 25, I'm facing 10 years without a license. I had a record. I had to convince employers how to hire me, give me a shot. I spent 16 years, that was 16 years ago, and, you know, I dug myself out from that, but I'm still paying the price for some of those bad choices. But along the way, I met a lot of other people that I never would have met in the world that I was living in before. I mean, I had economic mobility, just like a lot of people. If you have economic mobility, you can live in, among the people you see. But once I met other people, I started to understand the systemic disadvantages that people have for no other reason based on where they live, their color, gender. And that's what motivated me to start getting into public policy about 10 years ago.
Catherine Shields.
Well, I think most of your listeners know me. I've been kind of on the scene for a while. I am, as you mentioned, I was on the council from 1987 through 1994. I was on the finance committee and chaired the aviation and operations committee. Then I was Jackson County executive for 12 years. After I left there, I did build affordable housing for a couple of years with Westside Housing, then took some time off. And then in 2015, I came back, ran again, and was elected and just finishing that first term.
You know, this is a hard job serving on the city council, at least it is in my view. Why do you want another 4 years?
Well, I enjoy, there are a lot of issues, hard issues facing our city, but I enjoy sitting down with other concerned citizens and figuring out solutions and then working with them and my fellow council members to put those solutions into action.
Robert, why do you want this job?
Well, I get that question a lot, and usually it's framed in why would I be foolish enough to take on a well-financed and political machine in Catherine Shields? And my answer is basically because I don't think we should have well-financed political machines in our local government. Our government is supposed to reflect the interests of all people, and that means bringing diverse skill sets that aren't just from career politicians. Like you said, I work in learning and development and also process improvement, so most of my work involves coming to organizations and finding solutions to problems by working with stakeholders, people smarter than me. I ask a lot of questions. I use facts and figures and data to drive decisions, not just opinion or political promises. And I think that the people of Kansas City, if they really want to see changes in the way that the government works in more of an accountability and transparency form, you have to be open to the idea that the people that have been there for 20 or 30 years, whether it's the last four or back and forth over three decades, it might be time to make a change. And I feel like that's something I'm offering.
What's the one thing you want to get done if you get on the council?
Well, the problem with the question, the one thing, is that there's no one thing that doesn't relate to five or six other things. So the one thing
I get
that,
it, but, okay. But what do you want to get done?
Well, I want us to shift our focus from economic development down in the area, the part of the city that I live. And I live down the River Market. I was born and raised in Northland. I moved downtown a few years ago, before, you know, more in the pioneering phase before all the luxury started happening. And I'm on record saying that as much as I love the development that we've done and some of the projects we've done, the reality is that we have given so much economic focus to the area that I live in down to Crown Center that we have been ignoring in big ways the parts of the city on the east and south city. So I want us to remove the focus, not completely stop development or, you know, what people call momentum, but to make sure that momentum is being felt by everybody. And that's going to include a culture change. You have to actually look at the policy decisions being made, what drives them, who's making them, who's really benefiting from them. Fact of the matter is that when you look at projects being proposed, if it doesn't have the word luxury to it, it tends to not pass. And that's a problem. And it goes to another issue that I don't know what our values are as a city anymore. I'm born and raised here. I've never had a mayor or a council person ever ask me as a citizen, what are my values? How do you measure projects if you don't know the values?
Catherine Shields, what do you want to get done if you're given one more term here?
Well, one of the things I've worked on over the last 4 years, and I've made some progress in educating my colleagues, is I really think we need to turn a focus back to basic infrastructure. You know, city staff, many people say, well, we have all these potholes because we had a hard winter. No, we did have a hard winter, but we have all these potholes because we do not have a systematic plan of asset management. And it is something that I have been pushing to get done and, frankly, have not yet been able to get it done. And I think it is key to the correct and beneficial use of the tax dollars that our citizens are giving us. Yeah.
Do you think the next city council, Catherine Shields, needs to start fresh with a new city manager?
No, I don't think that's necessary. I think Troy's a very intelligent person. He certainly worked well with the last and closely with the last mayor. And I think if he chooses to align himself and work with the next mayor, whoever it is, I think he'll probably have a successful another 4 years.
Robert, do you want to see a new city manager?
Not yet. I'll be honest, I'm not going to, you know, publicly say that he should stay or go. His contract doesn't expire till next March. I'd like to do a thorough review of his actions and his leadership skills. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I am worried about a few things that he has said. One in particular, back in February, he tweeted out that residential and commercial rents downtown are not high enough yet to allow for projects to go through without substantial public subsidy. Mm-hmm. So in other words, he's saying that it's the policy of the city to prop up rent values to the point where developers will come in, which in effect means taxpayers are financing their own gentrification and evictions. And that is not a policy that I subscribe to. We had Reaganomics back in the 80s or trickle down. Now I call this spillover. We'll put all our money into the downtown area and we'll reshape it into a non-diverse form. And then we're telling the rest of the city we'll get to you when we can. In addition, you're already seeing that the effects of these policies are affecting places in Midtown and on the east side of the periphery where landlords are looking at six blocks away, they're getting, you know, $1,200 a month for rent. They're telling their tenants at renewal time, I'm hiking your rent up $500.
Now, Robert, would you pledge not to raise taxes during your four-year term if you're elected? Because you hear some Kansas Cityans starting to say, I'm getting tired of all the taxes.
No, I'm not going to make that pledge. I think anybody who did would be disingenuous. First of all, they can't tell what 4 years from now is going to be like. But here's the second thing. There are people who are financially strapped who've taxed taxes hurt them. But there are other people who are not as financially strapped, but they're not seeing value. The reality is taxes are how we do government. It's not necessarily the taxes themselves. It's whether they're being used intelligently, whether they're being used equitably, and if they're going to be used to only benefit a few handful of winners as opposed to the entire city. So what I'm talking about is let make the institution of local government worthy of the trust of the citizens, show that we're using the tax dollars wisely so that we can then, if we need to, down the road, be honest and say we will come back and get more money. But I don't think anybody can honestly say no taxes for 4 years.
Have we had enough of tax increases, Catherine Shields?
Well, I think, again, that we do have high taxes here. We have a generous community. Look at the health levy. Look at the mental health levy. Look at the 1/8 cent sales tax for the central city. Look at the $800 million bond issue. We have a citizens that have responded to needs set out by their elected officials. And as we know in Kansas City and everywhere in Missouri, of course, elected people can't raise taxes. They can only put issues before the voters for the voters to decide. But I do think that, that going forward, we have to make a case that we are spending the current taxes wisely. And I don't believe at this moment that we can. And we have to be able to make a case if there are other issues we want to bring forward, the value of those issues. Is as if you saw on the sales tax for early childhood development, I didn't talk to anybody who didn't think that early childhood development was important, but they did not think that the program that was being proposed actually brought the results that were being suggested.
Would you like to take another whack at early childhood education with another revised proposal before city voters?
What I would like to do is work with the school districts to see what, since they are the people that, first of all, have the education and the experience,
right,
to work with them to find from them how they think it ought to be structured and how they think it ought to be financed, and work with them to help them achieve that goal, not to set up a whole new separate bureaucracy to run a program that, in my mind, is best left in the hands of the educators.
How about early childhood education, Robert Westfall? What do you want to do there?
Well, I agree, because it is actually part of my field, is the fact that I see from the adult side what happens when education isn't robust from an early stage. The reality, though, is it does need to be handled from the school districts. The city's role in this is actually to make sure the school districts have the funding they need to put these programs into place, which goes right back to the when we do TIF projects that take away taxes at a 50 or 75% level for 20 years from a school district, we no longer are giving them the funds. So that's where I think the city's government role in early education should be first and foremost. I do believe that there needs to also be a look at the continuum. You're talking about doing early education pre-K, but what happens from first, second, and third grade if they're not getting a quality education in those 3 years? All the work you did early, you know, doesn't pay off. Mm-hmm. So we need to focus that way. I do have to say one thing, and I apologize, but I have to put my voter hat on as opposed to my candidate hat. We're talking about having trust with taxes and trust with our politicians. You had Quentin Lucas on here the other day, and you asked him point blank about the $75 million affordable housing plan. And you asked him, where's this money coming from? And after about a minute and a half, he kind of came up with, I think, maybe $9 million of it, if we're lucky.
Right.
Okay, well, you know, Quentin and Catherine are, you know, they're helping each other with their campaigns. They're both supporting each other. And she's been on the campaign trail advocating this as a legislative victory. But I got to ask, where's the other $65 million coming from?
Well, first off, you don't put anything together without beginning to have a goal. You have to have a goal in mind. And I think there are a number of ways that we can begin to do it. First of all, we get about $8 million from the federal government for affordable housing. We need to look and see if we are spending that in the most beneficial way. We actually, and I think we don't know the answer to that yet. Secondly, I think we have the 1/8 cent sales tax. We just approved the first round of that about $7 million. And of that, the vast majority went to creating affordable housing, to either, for the most part, renovating existing housing.
Hey, how could we not know your point to how we're spending the federal dollars? You said that we're not sure we're spending that money appropriately. Well, how could we not know that?
Well, I think the answer, I guess appropriately is not the right word. I think I should say to the most beneficial effect. We have individuals that every year those funds go to. And I think the question is, we need to look and evaluate in the light of a broader housing policy whether the ways we have traditionally spent those monies are the most effective ways.
Let me just say this before I let Robert chime in here. You're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking to the two candidates for the 4th District at large position on the city council. Every voter in Kansas City will have a chance to pass judgment here on these two candidates. They're the incumbent, Catherine Shields. She is being challenged by Robert Westfall. Robert, where do you want to get $75 million?
I don't know if we're going to get $75 million, so I would have been more practical and put smaller targeted plans in front of the voters and in front of the council and work from there. The reality, we're going back to, you know, you just said the voters have a chance to chime in. Well, we're going to be lucky to have 20% voter participation. Where's the other 80%? It's because they don't trust the system. And I go back to what she just said a minute ago.
Or they think the system's working pretty well.
You know, I don't know if that's real. I mean, that may be true for some, but, you know, I err on the side of caution. I think we can always do better, so I'm not going to rest on my laurels. But more importantly, the fact is, again, she's talking about this as it's an aspirational goal, but that's not the way she markets it out on the campaign trail. She's telling people we have passed the $75 million affordable housing. She leaves out the second sentence, which is we don't really have the money for it. And that's a disingenuous political game that a professional politician will do.
Let
Catherine
me talk
responds.
A minute.
Yeah.
First of all, I don't talk about how we have the $75 million. Although, if you look at the 1/8 cent sales tax, which will run for 10 years, 10 years times $10 million a year is $100 million. So I don't think it is without merit that we can put this sum of money. It's not $75 million a year. It's a goal of having a trust fund of that amount. Also, in the last year, we had new revenues come into the city from all these scooter rentals and the agreements we have. That's now being predicted to bring in about $1 million a year. And I asked my colleagues, and they agreed to put those funds into the trust fund for affordable housing. So I think there are a lot of ways to put it together. And I think that if we have the right mix of people on the next council, that we will move forward to do that. And I think we'll make some significant improvement. For example, one of the things that's been done in the past is when you had vacant housing, the city has just gone in and torn it down. If you look at Wendell Phillips' neighborhood, 70% of their homes have been torn down and they just have vacant lots. I mean, that's no way to have anything beneficial happening in that neighborhood. I have proposed and got the council to agree to take at least some of the $10 million that the mayor wanted to do for demolition and use it for renovating existing houses and putting them back in private ownership. And we did over 100 houses based on that. So
Robert,
are a lot of different things to put together.
One of Catherine Shields' colleagues, Scott Wagner, on the city council has proposed a fairly small property tax increase devoted to affordable housing. Could you support it?
I'd have to see exactly if we could do it in a way that maybe wouldn't negatively affect those at the lower levels of the income stratosphere, because the reality is, we go back to what we said earlier, there are people who are actually financially strapped to the point where more taxes are going to negatively hurt them, whereas there are those who actually could afford another property tax hike.
Right.
It goes back to being able to justify it and show it's going to work. In terms of what I think she was describing a minute ago, you know, we have community land trusts where neighborhoods can actually help take ownership of land and be able to dictate how the land will be used. That's something we need to work harder on. I know in the Marble community, they've been doing something like that. But going back to what you said earlier about how could she not know whether it was, you know, appropriately being used, I have to say, you know, the city auditor came out about, you know, 2 months ago with a report lambasting the entire council for acting in an ad hoc, reactive, non-strategic way when it comes to tax incentives. It wasn't just about one parking garage. It was about a systemic problem. This is the city auditor talking, not just my words, but this is the auditor whose job it is to oversee and verify how people are doing. And that is her view, that the city council was acting in a way that's not strategic. We can't afford to be doing things in a reactive way when developers come with us with proposals and we aren't actually targeting things outward.
Catherine, has the council not been strategic enough?
Well, you have a history from when Kay Barnes was here. She granted pretty generous, not just tax abatement, but additional city funding to create the entertainment district downtown and then One Light, and put in place a development agreement that said we would provide parking for 2 light, 3 light, 4 light, and on for actually, I think, a 99-year agreement. What I argued when three light came up, because one and two had obviously already been approved before I was there, that we were not committed to that. We were not legally committed to that development agreement,
right,
because we had not provided the funds. And it's very clear Missouri law that if you say, hey, this city's going to do X, but you don't appropriate the money to do X, that is a that is an outline of an agreement. It is not actually a legally enforceable agreement. So I argued and was able to get five other votes, but not six other votes, that in fact we should not be moving forward to fund three light, four light, etc., because of the that I thought we had more important issues to be doing. And again, those projects are funds that are already receiving 100% tax abatement. This is additional city dollars of, in, like with three lights, $17.5 million above the 100% tax abatement.
I want to move on to a different topic here, one we haven't discussed with my candidate interviews in recent days. What more, Robert, should Kansas City be doing to combat climate change? What's do you see as Kansas City's responsibility to its citizens when it comes to that issue?
Well, its responsibility is first and foremost to provide clean air, clean water, and clean soil. When we start talking about climate change, you know, people start to get the political football kicked around because of such a concept that's so broad. But focusing on those three things, those are things that the city government must ensure are there for the citizens. Now, in terms of how do we go forward with that, there's several things. There's personal responsibility. Everybody should be able to do things that can actually reduce water usage, recycle. But we also, as a city, need to make those things easier to be done. Now, the city council has actually, and I admire this one, is that they've announced that the city is going to be 100% renewable in a few years. And I plan on, as a member of the city council, make sure that it's not just a political football, but actually gets done. But more importantly, we have to also look at it from an economic development standpoint. We can actually benefit from this change in opinion going around the country about the renewable fuel usage, and by getting into the economic development side of it. One of the issues for years was the battery storage and transportation of energy was difficult, but that's actually gotten better now. And we can actually do it at a lower cost. So I think we need to start putting some small pilot programs together where we can actually put jobs together along with using certain residential areas, and you see if we can actually put together a little ecosystem of putting solar panels. We can do
Is that city government's responsibility?
Well, I think it's not, I mean, not in terms of maybe a mandate itself, but I mean, there are certain ways we can work with our private partners to do things such as that. We talk about public-private partnerships all the time, and the fact that we will give some support if they're willing to come in to the table in an equitable fashion. So
Catherine Shields, climate change, where do you want to go next?
Well, I want to go everywhere we can as fast as we can. If you look at my history in terms of environmental action, I have always been very supportive and very active in finding creative ways. For example, when we built the Jackson County Jail, we had the situation that we had to have the garbage hauled off every day because you're in a downtown situation and you have all that food waste. So we worked with a private company to create a composting company. We provided them their first contract, which allowed them, they come in every day and take the take the waste, the food waste, and compost it. And that allowed them a base where they reached out to other institutions and restaurants across this city. That took, that saved us almost $48,000, because while the contract cost $10,000, we in fact saved $48,000 in hauling costs. He alluded to what we're doing with the city and with KCP&L, a public-private partnership, where we are we have committed to buy fossil-free electricity from them into the future. And we again have provided the base customer. They now need to pick up a few more customers so that they can in fact put the wind farms and expanded solar panels in place to do that. But the city definitely can be, because of our buying power, we can definitely be a focus and an activator for change happening in our community. And I will say, in terms of Kansas City, Missouri, we are doing that now.
I'm running really short of time. 30 seconds, Robert. What do you want to do on crime?
Give me three bullet
points.
More beat cops actually building a relationship with the community, not just a community interaction officer, but cops that are out on the street making relationships.
You want to hire more or just have...
I want to look, see, maybe we get a big group of the administrative level back out on the street. Let's look at that first. Local control, they'll give us the ability to do that.
Local control of the state, of the police department from state government.
In addition,
government.
Also, I want us to have a look at our justice reform system and the fact that we're putting away a whole generation of nonviolent offenders, and when they come back out, not only are they facing the obstacles of the poverty and disadvantage that they're at, but now they have a record.
Catherine Shields.
I think we've made a good start at the city in terms of putting social workers into every precinct so that when the beat cop goes out and sees problems beyond just the infraction, they, in fact, report that back to the social workers who can then go out and help the families with the more systemic problems that's leading them to anger and violence. And I think that's a very important first step. I also agree with more close connection between the police and our neighborhoods, and I think we're also beginning to see more of that. In the last two budgets, we have included additional positions for police officers, and I think those are some of the things. I also think, finally, we never need to give up, both at the national and the state level, on pushing for sensible gun safety regulation. We can't stop pushing for that.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Those are our two candidates for the 4th District at large for Kansas City City Council. Again, they're the incumbent, Catherine Shields, being challenged by Robert Westfall. Thank you both for good conversation.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll meet Kansas's new Poet Laureate. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the program, U.S. Representatives Emanuel Cleaver and Sharice Davids discussed two big topics, the impeachment and Robert Mueller's resignation. Hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Next week, more from Kansas City's many, count them six, city council races. We'll meet candidates from the 2nd, 3rd, and 5th districts and join us on Wednesday for a mayoral debate live from Union Station. That's all next week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, in April, Waskar Medina was named Poet Laureate of Kansas. In doing so, he became the first Latino to hold the position. He says he came out of nowhere as he assumes his new post. Medina might be seen as undergoing a dynamic transformation as a self-described private person who now has to detach himself from himself to perform to someone who now has to operate as something of a public person. How's that going? We're about to find out. Waskar Medina is a poet, playwright, and member of Topeka's Speakeasy Poetry Group and the Red Tail Collective of Lawrence. As Lit Section Editor for 785 Magazine, he writes to increase the visibility of literary artists throughout Kansas. Waskar, welcome. Congratulations.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate the invitation.
How is it living life as an introvert in an extrovert's world as the Kansas Poet Laureate?
You know, I think sometimes there's a misconception about that. It's not a social issue. It's how you recharge.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a great gift for a writer to be able to be alone and spend time alone and not need other people to recharge. You can sit there for hours and write.
Right.
So it's a gift in that sense. But as a public figure, you know, I have to be prepared to share energy now.
It's a new deal.
It is.
How do you like it?
I'm enjoying it for the most part. Recently, I've met more and more people, more poets are, you know, hi, my name is, you know,
yeah.
So I'm having that experience on a daily basis at this point, and I love connecting with people.
Mm. You're going to be on the road a lot. Tell us a little more about what the Kansas Poet Laureate is charged to do.
It is my job. It is a privilege to go through Kansas and share poetry with areas that normally don't have access to the arts. We partner up with libraries. I've met a lot of librarians recently, very respectful people, very timely, and they're very passionate about sharing art. And in this particular form, it's poetry, and it's what I love to do, and I'm passionate about it.
So you're going to some small towns in Kansas
very
that don't normally
towns.
See poet laureates run through them, probably.
Yes. As far out as I've gotten up to this point without the position, it's probably Salina. You know, mm-hmm. I still travel out and try to be at, like, the Smoky River Festival out there. You know, I've read poetry in those areas. But I'm going to go way out. you know, and I'm really excited about that.
Yeah. What else is the Poet Laureate supposed to do?
Promote work, promote the work of other poets, right. which is something I already do in Northeast Kansas, you know, as a lit editor for 785 Magazine. So I'm prepared to do that. Most of the reading I do is local Kansas poets. I don't really pay attention to what's going on nationally. I'm really concerned about where poetry is in Kansas. And I want to be able to, you know, share that with Kansans who don't know that there are poets probably in their own town.
Mm-hmm. Waskar Medina, Kansas's new Poet Laureate, is my guest. What's the secret to appreciating poetry?
It's a very good question. I always, one of my favorite quotes, and I say this constantly, is T.S. Eliot, genuine poetry can be felt before it is understood.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a good line.
And yeah,
I like that.
It touched me. I felt something when I read it, right?
Yes.
And I feel it's a way to open up communication with people. That's what poetry is for me.
Yeah.
It's what I want to do with it. Good poetry is something you feel, and it allows you to later then understand.
You know, you get a sense these days that in our culture in these times with rap and, you know, beat poetry, hip hop, all those kinds of things, that poetry is making something of a comeback. You know, people have shorter attention spans, and reading a poem, which tends to be shorter than a novel, is a good path for a lot of people to go down.
It is. It's a gateway drug to more literature.
Is that how you view it?
That's how I view it. I think it's easily accessible. I mean, we have Instagram poets are really popular, you know, who write really short poems. But, you know, people gravitate to it because within those few lines, they connect it. They didn't need to read a book start to finish 200 plus pages to feel like they're understood or not alone in the world.
And that's the power of poetry, right? You make the point using an incredible economy of words.
The right word in the right place is everything.
And there's the art, right? That's what you struggle over. We've had U.S. Poet Laureates in here at 4 o'clock in the morning. That's what they're struggling over, the right word in the right place.
All the time.
Yeah. Were you expecting this designation as Poet Laureate of Kansas? Did you see it coming?
I wanted it down the road.
Mm-hmm.
But time provides opportunity, and that time was now, and I'm in the now, and I'm accepting it.
Were you surprised when you got the call?
Oh, yes. Let's be honest. I was. I really was. I'm not a typical poet laureate, I guess you could say. I'm not an academic.
Hmm.
You know.
Do you have to be an academic to be a poet laureate? We'll find out.
we'll find out real soon. Yeah, we will. At least in Kansas, we'll find out. I generally feel like they have a more established background. They're more likely to be listened to and not questioned as much. You know, I've been invited to do things, and some of the questions that I'm asked are, have you ever done a workshop before? You know, I don't believe these are questions that they would have been asked because they, you know, they have PhDs in the field.
Right,
you know?
Right.
And I have. You know, I've done workshops and conferences before.
So when the call came, you were a little surprised.
Oh, yes. Of course I was. I think to want something and to have an opportunity to get it sooner than you expected. Yes, I know the quality of my work. Mm-hmm. I'm very sure of my writing. I just didn't know other people were aware of the quality of my work.
Yeah. Well, let's do this. I wonder, we've been talking about poetry. Maybe you could read something from your forthcoming book, and it's titled Un Mango Grows in Kansas. And this poem is called Nuevo America.
Correct.
Gives us a good insight into you, I think.
I believe so. Nuevo America. Don't call me immigrant. I'm the new American, striving in new America as a new American. I'm not your invader, not an animal nor criminal. I'm a just person, just striving in a new America. In new America, I am a full-time student, overtime worker, volunteering in my free time if I plan enough ahead for free time, if I can even afford the free time, if my free time is approved. I work hard in new America. Third shift warehouse, second shift my house, always on call, no days off, freelance for life, four jobs a week, blue and white collar. Don't call me immigrant. I'm the new American, surviving in new America as a new American. I'm not your invader, not an animal nor criminal. I'm a just person, just surviving in a new America. This is new America. Student loans for all, high rent, high utilities, low pay, rising health care costs, the cost of living deadly, no living wage, living enraged because my cousins are in cage for wanting to live in a safer part of new America. Don't call me immigrant. I'm the new American, living in new America as a new American. I'm not your invader, not an animal nor criminal. I'm a just person, just living in a new America. Strong and proud, able to withstand the distance I have traveled, the distance from my family, the distance in between us, the distance of our dialects, the distance in our churches, the distance in our homes, the distance between my ancestors and my grandchildren, the distance from the streets to the dorm room, the distance from the field to the corner office suite. Don't call me immigrant. I'm the new American, dreaming of new America. As a new American, I'm not your invader, not an animal nor criminal. I'm a just person, just dreaming of a new America. Old America, don't be afraid. We're all America, North America, Central America, and South America. We are all Americas. We all strive in Americas. We all survive in Americas. We all live in Americas. They are all the same America. We all dream of a greater America. I want you to be paid a living wage, live in affordable housing, without college debt or medical debt or credit card debt or national debt. I want no more racism. I'm speaking of a new America. I am part of new America, whether you like it or not. So please join me.
Waskar Medina, the new Kansas Poet Laureate, reading his poem, Nuevo America. You don't like that word immigrant.
I don't think I need to use it anymore. I'm here. I'm living here now. See me.
For who I am.
Correct.
You know, you're the first Latino to hold the position of Kansas Poet Laureate. You know, to what extent do you feel a responsibility to that community as you go forward?
I need to reach out to the other Latino poets that are around. You know, we're not seen. You know, we have to create our own, you know, poet collectives, mm-hmm. you know, we have to have our own presses to have work published.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a time now for me to, if the door is open for me, to bring my friends along, you know?
Yeah. I was really struck as you read that poem. There's a real anger there. There's anger there in the way you read it. And I'm wondering why.
I think it's the way I talk. I mm-hmm. think it's just, I'm a bit, you know, bombastic sometimes.
But there is, but is there anger there?
There's a sternness. There's a seriousness about what I'm writing. It's mm-hmm. not. It's not generally beautiful, that experience. So I'm not going to be flowery or soft with my words.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not complaining. I'm making a statement. I'm being declarative. So if it sounds strong, it's because it's coming from a very honest and real place.
Huh. The poem suggests that there's a lot that the rest of us don't know about your world and the challenges that so many Latinos face. Do you find that discouraging?
I did when I was younger.
That we don't get it?
I did when I was younger, but it's up to people like me in public positions to bring it into the light and to be really honest and vulnerable, regardless of how it's taken.
And that's what that poem's about.
Exactly.
You're trying to tell me what your world's about.
Yes.
And how I should treat you and how I should respect you.
Yes, I'm not asking.
You're telling me.
I'm telling you, yeah.
Yeah, okay. You know, I read that you're organizing the inaugural Hispanic Heritage Month Poetry Spotlight and Outreach in September. What are you trying to do there?
I am reaching out to community outreach programs in the area, providing them free space and equal time with poets who are also brown, bringing the community together, offering them, you know, there's organizations that help people learn better English. There's organizations that help with housing, help people get jobs. These organizations are separate. So I'm creating a central location where we can all meet up and speak.
And where are you going to do that?
at the Topeka Shawnee County Public Library. They're offering me the auditorium space there.
You know, you weren't born in Kansas. Tell us about your upbringing.
I am from Texas by way of my mother and father, who are Puerto Rican and Panamanian. I was born on an army base. My father was a drill sergeant. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the structure, that life when I had it. It was really good for me.
Because it was a real structured youth?
It was.
Given your father's military bent?
Oh, yeah.
You're smiling as you say it. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I had boot camp.
Yeah.
At a really young age.
Household was boot camp.
Correct.
Why was that a positive thing?
I like routine. I like habit.
Mm-hmm.
I think with habit and routine, you can grow. You can build off of that. You know, it's easier to build with equal size bricks, you know. So that's what he did. He gave us a foundation, and it was solid.
How'd you get to Kansas?
My mother moved up here. My parents divorced, and she remarried, and the gentleman she was married to moved up here. His family's from Kansas. And I was living with my aunt in San Antonio, and I graduated high school, and I wanted to get reacquainted with my family. It was a couple of years I was away.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever, in your wildest dreams, think you'd wind up living in a state like Kansas?
I did not. Not at all. A lot of my friends were like, why did you move to Kansas? Well, family, of course. And it's usually family, especially when you're, you know, first generation in this country. There's not real immediate family around. So you tend to stay really close to your support group, which is incredibly small.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to stay connected to that.
And so you go where they go.
That's usually how it goes. Correct.
Yeah. Here you are, the poet laureate of Kansas. I mean, that's kind of amazing.
It's a turnaround.
Yeah. Hey, I mean, you're what, mid-30s?
I am 36.
Are you the youngest poet laureate we've had in Kansas?
I believe so, yes. That's a correct statement.
How does that feel?
I feel like I have big shoes to fill. I have a lot more experience with writing and poetry. So I have a lot of work to do.
Where'd your interest in poetry come from?
Introversion.
Huh.
Having to find a way to express myself without having to openly express myself.
Did a teacher introduce you to the whole idea of poetry, or do you stumble into it?
I stumbled into it. I just picked it up. One of the earliest books I picked up that I just completely fell in love with Lyrics of Lowly Life, Paul Lawrence Dunbar's book.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his story is interesting, teaching himself how to read, you know. Mm-hmm. I think he worked for an elevator, like he just, you know, what floor? That's what he did. And then he ended up writing some amazing poetry that inspired other poets like, you know, Maya Angelou.
Hmm. Well, poetry and being the poet laureate of Kansas isn't the only thing you do. You got a day job, right?
I do. I do have a day job. I'm blue collar. I do maintenance work. You know,
in a apartment complex.
A hotel.
Right? Hotel chain. Complex.
Yeah.
Okay.
I travel to different locations, and if anything's fixed, I take care of it.
So you're a handy guy.
Yeah, handy and artsy. That's a good mix.
I was just going to say, you're just taking my next question. You don't see that combination all that often, do you?
No, I don't. But I'm happy to break the mold. I think that's what I'm trying to do here, you know.
Yeah. You know, you're pretty bullish on the Topeka art scene, and you've poured a whole lot of energy into it. People around these parts don't typically associate Topeka with a thriving arts community, although I was just talking to a friend of mine yesterday who was saying that, you know, Topeka's starting to move a little bit when it comes to reorienting itself a little bit, becoming a little bit more of an interesting city. Set us straight. Is Topeka changing?
It is. We have a lot of momentum. We're progressing. We're really invested in our artists. We want to retain young professionals in our area, and I think we understand that to do that, we got to be able to entertain them.
Mm-hmm. You say Topeka is a serious art town. What do you mean?
We take care of our artists. We have the Artist Wellness Endowment, which helps with medical bills for artists.
What do you have? An
Artist Wellness Endowment.
Wow.
And that's artists taking care of artists. Mm-hmm. We take care of ourselves and each other. We're a tribe out here, and we see it and we acknowledge it, and we lift ourselves by lifting each other.
Mm-hmm. That's kind of a neat deal.
It is a very neat deal.
How did you find each other in Topeka?
I just showed up wherever the art was. That's just, that's what it was. And talking and meeting people, you know, I do visual art. I do musical theater, you know, the playwright. I mean, I'm involved in a lot of different mediums. So I've connected really well out there. And we started, they started before I arrived, you know, to really try to build the art community. And one of the organizations that's really impactful in that is Arts Connect. It's a local art agency where we're at. And they help give out grants. The event that I'm doing, it's through a grant, through a, you know, Topeka Arts.
Yeah. So when do you find the time to do your reading and writing?
Late after everything else is done, after I check the day off and I've completed all my tasks, then I sit down and I get to the real work.
And that's what you enjoy most?
Yes.
Where do you do it?
I move around a lot. I'll be at home and then I'll go to the library. And if I get tired there, and it's later in the day, the weekends I write a lot. I'll go to a coffee shop. I invite people to write with me all the time. It's a solitary
craft. I was
going to
say, how do you write with other people?
You ignore them. You just sit across them.
But they're there.
They're there.
It's more of a social situation.
It's like a support group. Yeah. It's like you're trying to find that synergy.
Yeah. You did a thing for KCUR earlier this month, and one of the things that KCUR tends to ask poet laureates, new poet laureates, is name the three rules to write by, and your number one rule was always be prepared to write.
Correct.
Do you do it on the job? You pull out the phone and make a few notes sometimes?
Yeah. Before the smartphone, it was a little pad of paper in my pocket, and then I make a note. You know, there's a word that'll just stick. I was like, man, that's a beautiful word. Where's that word come from? Let me go figure out what I can do with this guy.
No kidding. Rule number two, you say, and I agree with this one, writer's block is not a real thing. What do you mean by that?
It's just a red flag that you're facing creative burnout. You need to still invest in your craft, but in a more positive way for yourself. So it's a detour.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a writer's detour. Go around it. Go find something to read that's related to the work you're doing, or go watch a film that's related to the work you're doing, or investigate the words you're trying to use for what you're writing.
You know, I wrote for the newspaper here for more than 30 years, and I found that the last 15, 20 years, I never had writer's block anymore. It just went away. I guess you overcome it somehow through years of just pounding away.
That's exactly
that was a beautiful, it. I recognized it was a beautiful thing. I never had to worry about it anymore.
That's how I feel. And I've been, you know, pounding away, you know, for a very long time, too. I mean, I started writing at a very young age, and it's what I've wanted to do my whole life. So
you don't get it anymore either?
No.
It's a thing of the past.
It's a thing of the past. Now, the quality of what I'm writing, that might be questionable sometimes, but the writing is being done.
Well, Oscar Medina, what a pleasure to meet you here, the new Kansas Poet Laureate. So good to have you here. I wish you all the best, and I hope you'll come back and see us sometime.
Thank you. I will.
Oscar Medina, again, the new Kansas Poet Laureate. Yesterday in the show, we sat down with U.S. representatives from both sides of the border. You can hear my conversation with Charisse Davids and Emmanuel Cleaver and other previous episodes. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. Monday, we dive into a cover-up between the Kansas Bureau of Investigation and the state attorney general to find out what it has to do with Truman Capote's best-selling book, In Cold Blood. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scherr, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Emily Aiken. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.